to St. Andrew's this morning. I want to talk about this gospel passage that really is, I think, more central than I had really been appreciative of in my years of ministry. But I'll get to that in a minute. I want to talk about a couple things first. First of all, Veterans Day. This is the weekend of Veterans Day. And I would like to honor, in a way that is appropriate to the complexity of a soldier's situation, honor the men and women who have served in military life. I've said before, I think Jesus liked soldiers. I think Jesus liked the way they were able to see what needed to be done and do it. They accepted orders. Do this, and they did it. And Jesus recognized that there was something about everyday life that has that quality. But, of course, soldiers, they're wonderful qualities. Heroism, courage, selflessness, you know, concern for the guy fighting next to them. All of those are exercised in the context of the greatest human evil, which is war. And I think we have to do both things. I think we have to hold up the price that soldiers pay, the terrible spiritual burdens that are imposed upon soldiers. And again, those of us who have never been in combat, I think, simply cannot understand what combat is like and the kinds of decisions that are made under that sort of duress. And I've talked to enough soldiers whose combat experience is behind them to know that those wounds do not easily go away. Not physical wounds, but spiritual wounds. What it's like to take life. What it's like to kill. Those are hard burdens. And every culture in the world has asked primarily its men to engage in this kind of relationship to other people, try to kill them. And it brings out some of the most glorious qualities of us as human beings, but the overarching intention is still, let's try to solve our problems by killing each other. And that's got to change. And so we honor these men, and we lament our human blindness and how resistant we are to finding different ways of solving our problems. Shooting each other, killing each other, bombing each other, it doesn't work. It keeps the same thing going over and over again, deepens it, makes our world, insofar as it is, kind of nightmarish. So, honor and sorrow, this kind of tragic heroism that we hold up today. So there's that for Veterans Day. I want to talk a little bit about Job. This passage of Job is, again, Job wrestling with God. And we catch it at the tail end of a passage. And the beginning, I think, is important because it once again puts us in, I think, an appropriate human place, which is we are driven to ask questions about the meaning of our lives and the fate and what we're doing here and whether the world or God is on our side or against us. And Job wrestles and wrestles and wrestles with this. And the passage, the verses immediately preceding it said, I don't know how this happened, but God is my enemy. God has set himself against me. It is God who has stricken me and has reduced me to this sort of tragic, comic figure that even my own family members won't acknowledge. I sit here, I've lost my property, I've lost most of my children, my land, my flocks, and I'm just sitting here in a pile of, in the rubbish heap, scratching my sores with a piece of broken pottery. I mean, bad day trending down for Job. And he says, God has done this to me. And of course, that reminds us that the beginning of the book of Job is very strange for Hebrew scripture. The beginning is kind of the guys hanging out in the court of heaven. It feels rather more Greek than Hebrew. Like you can imagine this happening on Olympus, you know, where let's make mischief. And in fact, that's what ensues. God is saying, my servant Job, what a wonderful guy he is. Well, also present in the court of God is the prosecuting attorney, the Satan. And he says, yeah, well, who wouldn't be grateful, O God, because you give him everything? You know, take his blessings away and he'll turn against you. Not my Job. And Satan says, I'll break this guy. You watch. God says, okay, bet's on. Again, not exactly the way we like to sort of sense ourselves to be comforted and nurtured by our good shepherd, you know, sort of giving us up to a bet. And so Job is wrestling because he says, God has done this to me. And then at the end he goes, and yet what I believe, what I entrust myself to, is that there is a God even deeper than these circumstances. There's a God deeper than my suffering. There's a God who will bring creation, including me, to fulfillment. I know that my vindicator, my redeemer, my avenger, it's kind of a complex word in Hebrew, lives, and at the last he will stand on the earth, and that I will not always be blasted by circumstance. But there is, you know, beneath everything I know, beneath everything I see, and beneath even everything I can experience, I entrust myself to the God beyond all human representations of God, who will stand on the earth and who will vindicate me. Which kind of leads us in a partial segue to the gospel. And this passage from the gospel seems to be, like I say, much more significant than I've really given it credit for being. I've never paid a lot of attention to it during the years of my ministry, and yet there it sits pretty much in the same place in all the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Pretty much identical wording. You don't see too many stories like that, but here you get a story that all three gospels record. This encounter between Jesus and the Sadducees. And I don't want this to be just us listening in on a sort of an argument about ideas that occurred 2,000 years ago. I want us to be a little more engaged in that. But it starts off. The Sadducees, they were one of the groups of Israel, the Sadducees and Pharisees, sort of chief Sadducees, aristocratic, often associated with the temple. And one of their tenets, they focused on the teachings of Moses and said, really, beyond that, there isn't anything. And so they're trying to trick Jesus. They're trying to set him up in what is really a comic situation. People are not used to laughing when scripture is read. They think it's irreverent. But actually, I imagine that they would have been chuckling to themselves. Oh, let's see Jesus get out of this one. So, you know, this, I don't know. I can't tell if it's this poor woman who finally dies after her seven husbands or the poor husbands who, you know, she just kills them all. I don't know. But anyway, seven, Jesus is getting caught up in this sort of absurd spectacle of this woman being married in succession by seven brothers. Okay, Jesus, if there's a resurrection, whose wife will this woman be? And Jesus just says, you guys are clueless. You don't understand anything about either our present situation or about the world to come. And Jesus was saying, the thing you really have to understand is that there is no direct continuity between this world and the next. There is no direct continuity between this world and the next. Who you are as a resurrected—this is this life. Who you are as a resurrected being is not exactly the same as who you are as you now know yourself. And I would offer this to us. We are all, in a sense, functional Sadducees to this degree. That most of us, most of the time, to the extent that we think at all about resurrection, can really only imagine it as a continuation of this. We extrapolate from what we know, who I know myself to be. And at its worst, this idea of resurrection sort of comes in the side door and in the end sort of subverts what Jesus was really trying to teach us, which is to say, you've got to actually let go of who you think you are. You actually, well, let's even use the metaphor, you have to die to who you think you are, because who you think you are and the person you've come to experience yourself to be, that is this compound of fear and desire and cultural attitudes, and prejudice, and anxiety, and that's not who you really are. That's sort of how you find yourself in this human experience. But resurrection, whatever it means, does not mean that this little self dies and then just returns. That's not it. And it sometimes sounds as if that's how we talk about resurrection. Resurrection is a symbol, and by that I don't mean that it's not real. I just mean that it points to a reality which we can't exactly understand. Resurrection is a symbol of our ultimate transformation. If you want to understand, and again, I say that, and I hear the words coming out of my mouth, and I say, what are you talking about? If you want to understand resurrection, well, we can't understand resurrection. But as a something for our imaginations to sort of look at, imagine who you would be if the only influence in your life were the love of God. If you were not shaped by your anxiety, if you were not shaped by your regret, or the things you're ashamed of, or the things you're angry about, but if you as a being were entirely sustained by the living, compassionate presence of God, that would be resurrection. That's what we hold up as that which awaits us. So I've often in the course of my life I've been reluctant to talk about resurrection. For that reason, because it simply seems like it's too closely tied to the longing of my little ego. You know, I want to be rich, I want to be powerful, I want to be famous without the burden of celebrity. I want to, you know, I mean, all the things that, you know, are sort of at work in our hearts. And what Jesus is saying, actually, what you want is to be reborn as a creature sustained by the love of God and with the love of God flowing through you in all ways and at all times. There's something that I'm... The other thing that Jesus was saying about God and also about death is that we are mistaken about death. Death is an event, and statistical evidence is overwhelming that it will claim all of us. You know, in scientific circles, they're always a little bit, you know, they step back from being absolutely predictive. They say, man, statistics. It's going to claim us all. But Jesus is saying, what you don't understand is that in God, there is no death. Death is an event that occurs to us, and we have very strong reactions to it. We are, in a sense, dominated by it. And many theologians really describe this human experience as being governed by systems and cultures that are all sort of enchanted by death. And Jesus says, in God, there is no death. What to us looks like a terminus, it looks like the end. From God's perspective, it's a change, and we don't know how God sees it. What Jesus is affirming to us is that there is no death in God, and that we are vastly mistaken about what we think the significance of death is. And of course, for Jesus did not want these to be merely ideas that are sort of presented to your brains for you to say yes or no. That sounds plausible. That sounds crazy. No. Whenever Jesus is teaching, these ideas are meant to be things that change our lives. How is it going to be different if you live in such a way that you are no longer afraid of death? How would that be? That the things that you feel like you're hanging on to, either in relation to other people or your own life, and of course, it's really difficult to know how afraid we are of death. One of those, you know, we're coming up to a season, you know, Advent. Advent and Lent are sort of the penitential seasons, but what that really means is it's a time of self-examination, and it's a time to look at one's heart and look for those discrepancies between what one espouses and the way one actually lives. And those two actually do not always meet up exactly. All self-examination, I think, would profitably inquire into that. Here's what I espouse. Here's how I actually live. How are they different? And how can I bring how I actually live into greater congruence with what I espouse? And I hope, as a Christian people, we espouse that though death looms in each of our futures, it is not what we think it is. It is not the thing to be in mortal dread of all our days. It's a matter of perspective. And from God's perspective, death is not the same thing as it is to us. So I want us to, maybe we should talk more about the other life, life beyond death, but not speculatively. I mean, the Norsemen, you know, with Valhalla, the Muslims, and the Mormons with their kind of suburban afterlife. We don't know what awaits us beyond this. And I often say this at Easter, if we want to give some indication of the imaginative difficulty, let's imagine that we are all children in the womb, and we are trying to imagine this. And I suspect that the change that awaits us in death is at least that momentous. It's at least that momentous. Let's use this time to remember we live in a very, very, very strange world. And that really nothing can be ruled out simply because it's improbable. Because there is nothing that is less probable than this. And that we are here, though we do not know where. And we do not know why. But here we are. And faith is not saying, yes, I think that idea is true. Faith is recognizing those points in one's life where it makes a great difference how you orient yourself. Is the universe hostile to me? Is the universe kind to me? You can actually marshal evidence on both sides of that question. You can't prove either one. But it makes a huge difference how you orient yourself. If you think the world and the universe and God are all hostile to you, your life will be very different than if you say, though the evidence is, in a sense, inconclusive, I entrust myself to a universe. I know that my vindicator will live and will stand upon the earth and that I will be recognized. I entrust myself to the source of all existence, who is beyond death, even beyond my own death. I will live in faith and in trust in relation to that reality, which is what I think Jesus asks us.